From National Public Radio, this is special coverage, President Bush's State of the Union Address. I'm Robert Siegel. The President will soon enter the chamber of the House of Representatives, where members of both chambers and many other notables are assembled, and he will speak probably for a bit over an hour. This annual event is inspired by Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution, which says, "The President shall from time to time give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient." From that constitutional recommendation has grown this annual event. Joining me this evening is NPR's Mara Liasson. Mara, welcome.
Thank you, Robert.
This is, of course, a president who is in his second term and quite experienced at giving State of the Union addresses. What do you think he has to accomplish tonight?
Well, I think he has to set out a roadmap or a blueprint for his own party. This is an election year, and the Republicans will be trying to maintain their majorities in both houses of Congress. He has to lay out a domestic agenda that will not conflict with the very tight budget constraints that he has, that will be acceptable to a pretty restive Republican conference on Capitol Hill. And also he has to kind of recapture what he's always felt were his strong points on foreign policy, the war against terror, and from reading bits of the speech that we've been able to, he's going to try to continue to put Democrats on the defensive on foreign policy.
Now, as you were speaking, the justices of the Supreme Court of the United States were introduced, and this is a different cast of characters from what we've seen in previous years. Chief Justice Roberts led the procession of the justices, and along with him was Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Samuel Alito, who was confirmed just today. Also taking part in this broadcast are two of our regular guest political observers, E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution, and also Rich Lowry of the National Review is joining us from New York today. Rich Lowry, what as you see it, is the objective of the president as we hear his cabinet being introduced to the chamber?
Well, a couple of things. One, as Mora referred to, he wants to emphasize his strength, which is the cluster of issues around national security. So you'll hear him reiterate the case he's made on the war on terror for going on 3 years now, and making a very aggressive defense of the NSA program that's been so controversial. I don't think he'll give an inch on that.
This is what he calls the terrorist surveillance program.
Correct. That's the new verbiage they've come up with. And on the domestic front, it'll obviously be much less ambitious than what we heard last year when he was pushing his program to reform Social Security. And on the domestic agenda, it'll be just enough to try to give Republicans enough to say and do in this coming year to get by and survive in what appears to be a very difficult political year for the House and Senate Republicans.
It's Rich Lowry, editor of the National Review. E.J. Dionne, columnist for the Washington Post. What do you think the mission is here tonight, having looked at the same text that we've all looked at?
I think the theme is, please let me remind you why you reelected me. You, the American people, seem to have forgotten. His approval ratings are in the high 30s, low 40s. I was very struck by a number in the new NBC Wall Street Journal poll. Only 38% now view the president as honest and trustworthy, down from 50% a year ago. That's a lot of repair work to do. I think a lot of Americans, clearly again from the polls, are unhappy with his handling of Iraq. They're unhappy with the economy, which looks good in certain ways, but has not really been lifting incomes. And this week was a real sort of blow to his foreign policy. The administration insisted on elections in the Palestinian territories, and lo and behold, they elected a Hamas government, which now the administration has to turn around and say, well, we were for these elections, but we can't deal with the people you elected. That's a real problem.
They have produced a majority party that is regarded by U.S. law as a terrorist organization.
Exactly, and is committed to the destruction of Israel. So that it's very awkward for a president who tonight, as always, will talk about the American goal of spreading democracy and free elections, and this one didn't turn out right from the administration's point of view, or for that matter, from the point of view of a lot of other people.
Rich Lowry, can the president honestly finesse that one?
Yeah, I think so. Look, I mean, the problem with elections, obviously, is they're not always going to turn out the way you like. And I don't think you'll obviously get into it in this in this sort of detail. But I think that election reflected the strength of Hamas in Palestinian society, the kind of strength that it had for a long time. And it was going to express itself one way or the other. At least now there's some clarity and arguably more honesty there on the ground.
I think the problem with that, I agree to some degree with what Rich said. I think the problem with that is we're in a very difficult position, the United States of America, because we really pushed everybody to have this election. The Israelis wanted it postponed. It looks like Mr. Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, wanted it postponed. We said we really want it, and then we just can't abide by the results. So we are stuck in at best, a contradiction there.
Back to NPR senior political correspondent. Mara Liasson, it is remarkable, Mara, how long a time a year in the life of a president of the United States and the political life of a president can be. This time last year, we were about to hear the reelected president of the United States, a man who spoke of the political capital he had acquired and he was going to start spending it.
That was the famous line last year. I've earned political capital and it's my style. I intend to spend it. And boy, did he. He actually, I don't know if he had as much as he thought, but he proceeded to push a very ambitious domestic agenda, the partial privatization of Social Security, and he pushed it and pushed it and couldn't even get his own party on Capitol Hill to accept it. This year, the domestic agenda is very pared down, quite modest. Health savings accounts are going to be the centerpiece of his approach to the health care cost problem. Healthcare is at the top of the polls when people are asked what is the thing that they're concerned about most, and he has a kind of free market answer to it, which would allow people to put away tax-free money into a savings account to pay for their own healthcare expenses. I'm sure Democrats will dismiss this as not enough, and we'll see if it's satisfying to the American people.
Around this time in the second Clinton administration, we were talking about other things as well, but we were beginning to talk about legacy, and it seemed to be a preoccupation of the Clinton White House to begin to create the legacy of that two-term presidency. What about this
president
White House?
Is concerned about legacy too. Although I think that when you saw the Supreme Court justices walk into the chamber, that is it. He doesn't have to do much else to have a lasting impact on American life for generations to come. He's already accomplished it.
The president's very fond of the word consequential, and I think that's what he's thinking about in terms of his legacy. I think on these, President Bush said he had a lot of political capital. This year he really needs a bailout, and that's part of what he's seeking in this speech.
Well, the doors to the House chamber are now opening for the guest of honor. This is the House of Representatives, and so the president is coming to the turf of another co-equal branch of government. And he should be introduced, we think, very shortly. When he does enter the chamber, we'll then be just counting down a little bit until he makes his way down the aisle. But the great knock on the door has not quite happened yet. There it is. Let's hear the announcement.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
That announcement from the Sergeant-at-Arms of the House of Representatives, and President George W. Bush enters the House chamber, and he'll be greeted by folks from both sides of the aisle as he approaches the podium. It's a classic scene that we on the radio can only summon an image of in our mind, but the president will stand at the podium, and behind him will be the two presiding officers of the two bodies, the Vice President of the United States, who is, of course, the President of the Senate by rights of the Constitution, and the Speaker of the House. That'll be Dick Cheney and Dennis Hastert, two men both of the President's party. And the President will say things that will lead those two gentlemen to rise in applause often throughout the next hour, as will those members of his own party who are seated in the House chamber, and sometimes, on some occasions, members of both parties will rise and there will be moments of bipartisanship. Indeed, the very idea of bipartisanship or civility, Mara, is a That's a word that one hears discussed a great deal. I don't know how seriously people really take it. Out in the country, they take it seriously. The country seems to be quite fed up with partisan bickering all the time.
Yes, that's kind of a staple. But there certainly has been plenty of it lately, and you could argue that the strategy that the president has adopted, and now Democrats seem to be looking at it too, of kind of playing to your base, trying to build on that, not worrying too much about appealing to the moderate middle. As a matter of fact, Karl Rove and others of the president's advisors don't even believe there is such a thing anymore. But the president will talk in this speech about civility and changing the tone. Of course, he talked about that when he came into office, and he promised he'd be a uniter, not a divider. And I guess certainly what has happened since then has not borne that out.
Among those in attendance this evening, in addition to those groups we've mentioned, the members of Congress, the Supreme Court, the Cabinet, also the Joint Chiefs, members of the Diplomatic Corps, and there always are special guests. Nowadays, this has become a tradition of State of the Union addresses, special guests of the First Lady, who sit with her in a box overlooking the House floor. The President has now arrived at the podium, and he's handed a text of his remarks to the presiding officers, Vice President Cheney and Speaker Hastert. He's acknowledging the applause of the members of Congress in the audience, and he should be beginning very shortly. We'll wait for Speaker Hastert to gavel the House to order here.
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and the distinct honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Mr. Speaker, Vice President Cheney, members of Congress, members of the Supreme Court and Diplomatic Corps, distinguished guests and fellow citizens. Today, our nation lost a beloved, graceful, courageous woman who called America to its founding ideals and carried on a noble dream. Tonight, we are comforted by the hope of a glad reunion with the husband who was taken so long ago, and we are grateful for the good life of Coretta Scott King.
And a general standing ovation in honor of the late Coretta Scott King by members of both parties on both sides of the aisle.
Every time I'm invited to this rostrum, I'm humbled by the privilege and mindful of the history we've seen together. We have gathered under this Capitol dome in moments of national mourning and national achievement. We have served America through one of the most consequential periods of our history, and it has been my honor to serve with you. In a system of two parties, two chambers, and two elected branches, there will always be differences and debate. But even tough debates can be conducted in a civil tone, and our differences cannot be allowed to harden into anger. To confront the great issues before us, we must act in a spirit of goodwill and respect for one another, and I will do my part. Tonight, the state of our union is strong, and together we will make it stronger. In this decisive year, you and I will make choices that determine both the future and the character of our country. we will choose to act confidently in pursuing the enemies of freedom, or retreat from our duties in the hope of an easier life. We will choose to build our prosperity by leading the world economy, or shut ourselves off from trade and opportunity. In a complex and challenging time, the road of isolationism and protectionism may seem broad and inviting, yet it ends in danger and decline. The only way to protect our people, the only way to secure the peace, the only way to control our destiny is by our leadership, so the United States of America will continue to lead. Abroad, our nation is committed to an historic long-term goal. We seek the end of tyranny in our world. Some dismiss that goal as misguided idealism. In reality, the future security of America depends on it. On September the 11th, 2001, we found that problems originating in a failed and oppressive state, 7,000 miles away, could bring murder and destruction to our country. Dictatorships shelter terrorists and feed resentment and radicalism and seek weapons of mass destruction. Democracies replace resentment with hope, respect the rights of their citizens and their neighbors, and join the fight against terror. Every step toward freedom in the world makes our country safer, so we will act boldly in freedom's cause. Far from being a hopeless dream, the advance of freedom is the great story of our time. In 1945, there were about 24 lonely democracies in the world. Today, there are 122. And we're writing a new chapter in the story of self-government, with women lining up to vote in Afghanistan, and millions of Iraqis marking their liberty with purple ink, and men and women from Lebanon to Egypt debating the rights of individuals and the necessity of freedom. At the start of 2006, more than half the people of our world live in democratic nations. And we do not forget the other half, in places like Syria and Burma, Zimbabwe, North Korea, and Iran, because the demands of justice and the peace of this world require their freedom as well. No one can deny the success of freedom, but some men rage and fight against it. And one of the main sources of reaction and opposition is radical Islam, the perversion by a few of a noble faith into an ideology of terror and death. Terrorists like bin Laden are serious about mass murder. And all of us must take their declared intentions seriously. They seek to impose a heartless system of totalitarian control throughout the Middle East and arm themselves with weapons of mass murder. Their aim is to seize power in Iraq and use it as a safe haven to launch attacks against America and the world. Lacking the military strength to challenge us directly, the terrorists have chosen the weapon of fear. When they murder children at a school in Beslan, or blow up commuters in London, or behead a bound captive, the terrorists hope these horrors will break our will, allowing the violent to inherit the earth. But they have miscalculated. We love our freedom, and we will fight to keep it.
Many members rising in a standing ovation in response to the president's call to continue his war against terror, the United States' war against terror, which he described as taking place not only in the Middle East, but in Russia.
In a time of testing, we cannot find security by abandoning our commitments and retreating within our borders. If we were to leave these vicious vicious attackers alone, they would not leave us alone. They would simply move the battlefield to our own shores. There is no peace in retreat, and there is no honor in retreat. By allowing radical Islam to work its will, by leaving an assaulted world to fend for itself, we would signal to all that we no longer believe in our own ideals or even in our own courage. But our enemies and our friends can be certain. The United States will not retreat from the world, and we will never surrender to evil.
Another big standing ovation.
America rejects the false comfort of isolationism. We are the nation that saved liberty in Europe and liberated death camps and helped raise up democracies and face down an evil empire. Once again, we accept the call of history to deliver the oppressed and move this world toward peace. We remain on the offensive against terror networks. We have killed or captured many of their leaders, and for the others, their day will come. We remain on the offensive in Afghanistan, where a fine president and a national assembly are fighting terror while building the institutions of a new democracy. We're on the offensive in Iraq with a clear plan for victory. First, we're helping Iraqis build an inclusive government so that old resentments will be eased and the insurgency will be marginalized. Second, we're continuing reconstruction efforts and helping the Iraqi government to fight corruption and build a modern economy so all Iraqis can experience the benefits of freedom. And third, we're striking terrorist targets while we train Iraqi forces that are increasingly capable of defeating the enemy. Iraqis are showing their courage every day, and we are proud to be their allies in the cause of freedom. Our work in Iraq is difficult because our enemy is brutal. But that brutality has not stopped the dramatic progress of a new democracy. In less than 3 years, the nation has gone from dictatorship to liberation, to sovereignty, to a constitution, to national elections. At the same time, our coalition has been relentless in shutting off terrorist infiltration, clearing out insurgent strongholds, and turning over territory to Iraqi security forces. I am confident in our plan for victory. I am confident in the will of the Iraqi people. I am confident in the skill and spirit of our military fellow citizens. We are in this fight to win, and we are winning. The road of victory is the road that will take our troops home. As we make progress on the ground and Iraqi forces increasingly take the lead, we should be able to further decrease our troop levels. But those decisions will be made by our military commanders, not by politicians in Washington, D.C.
Perhaps an oblique reference to calls for a timeline for a withdrawal from Iraq that the president rejects.
Our coalition has learned from our experience in Iraq. We've adjusted our military tactics and changed our approach to reconstruction. Along the way, we have benefited from responsible criticism and counsel offered by members of Congress of both parties. In the coming year, I will continue to reach out and seek your good advice. Yet there is a difference between responsible criticism that aims for success and defeatism that refuses to acknowledge anything but failure. Hindsight alone is not wisdom, and second-guessing is not a strategy. With so much in the balance, those of us in public office have a duty to speak with candor. A sudden withdrawal of our forces from Iraq would abandon our Iraqi allies to death in prison, would put men like bin Laden and Zarqawi in charge of a strategic country, and show that a pledge from America means little. Members of Congress, however we feel about the decisions and debates of the past, our nation has only one option. We must keep our word, defeat our enemies, and stand behind the American military in this vital mission.
Standing ovation for those remarks. Later we're going to hear a Democratic response, and we're going to hear a different view of whether it's still germane to debate the origins of how the U.S. Got into Iraq. But for now, the president is saying that discussion is over.
Our men and women in uniform are making sacrifices and showing a sense of duty stronger than all fear. They know what it's like to fight house to house in a maze of streets, to wear heavy gear in the desert heat, to see a comrade killed by a roadside bomb. And those who know the costs also know the stakes. Marine Staff Sergeant Dan Clay was killed last month fighting in Fallujah. He left behind a letter to his family, but his words could just as well be addressed to every American. Here's what Dan wrote. I know what honor is. It has been an honor to protect and serve all of you. I faced death with the secure knowledge that you would not have to. Never falter. Don't hesitate to honor and support those of us who had the honor of protecting that which is worth protecting. Staff Sergeant Dan Clay's wife, Lisa, and his mom and dad, Sarah, Joe, and Bud, are with us this evening. Welcome.
The Clay family, seated in the gallery overlooking the House chamber floor, stood, and they're acknowledged by the members of Congress below and all of the other notables assembled for the State of the Union address. They're being applauded, of course, in honor of their late son, husband's gallantry in Iraq.
Our nation is grateful to the fallen who live in the memory of our country. We're grateful to all who volunteered to wear our nation's uniform. And as we honor our brave troops, let us never forget the sacrifices of America's military families. Offensive against terror involves more than military action. Ultimately, the only way to defeat the terrorists is to defeat their dark vision of hatred and fear by offering the hopeful alternative of political freedom and peaceful change. So the United States of America supports democratic reform across the broader Middle East. Elections are vital, but they are only the beginning. Raising up a democracy requires the rule of law, protection of minorities, and strong, accountable institutions that last longer than a single vote. The great people of Egypt have voted in a multi-party presidential election, and now their government should open paths of peaceful opposition that will reduce the appeal of radicalism. The Palestinian people have voted in elections, and now the leaders of Hamas must recognize Israel, disarm, reject terrorism, and work for lasting peace.
That sentiment shared by the Congress. Many members rise, applauding the president's call to Hamas to recognize Israel, disarm, reject terrorism, and work for lasting peace. Those are demands that the leaders of Hamas have pretty clearly rejected over the past few days.
Saudi Arabia has taken the first steps of reform. Now it can offer its people a better future by pressing forward with those efforts. Democracies in the Middle East will not look like our own, because they will reflect the traditions of their own citizens. Yet liberty is the future of every nation in the Middle East, because liberty is the right and hope of all humanity. The same is true of Iran, a nation now held hostage by a small clerical elite that is isolating and repressing its people. The regime in that country sponsors terrorists in the Palestinian territories and in Lebanon, and that must come to an end. The Iranian government is defying the world with its nuclear ambitions, and the nations of the world must not permit the Iranian regime to gain nuclear weapons. America will continue to rally the world to confront these threats. Tonight, let me speak directly to the citizens of Iran. America respects you, and we respect your country. We respect your right to choose your own future and win your own freedom. And our nation hopes one day to be the closest of friends with a free and democratic Iran. To overcome dangers in our world, we must also take the offensive by encouraging economic progress and fighting disease and spreading hope in hopeless lands. Isolationism would not only tie our hands in fighting enemies, it would keep us from helping our friends in desperate need. We show compassion abroad because Americans believe in the God-given dignity and worth of a villager with HIV/AIDS. Or an infant with malaria, or a refugee fleeing genocide, or a young girl sold into slavery. We also show compassion abroad because regions overwhelmed by poverty, corruption, and despair are sources of terrorism and organized crime and human trafficking and the drug trade. In recent years, you and I have taken unprecedented action to fight AIDS and malaria, expand the education of girls, and reward developing nations that are moving forward with economic and political reform. For people everywhere, the United States is a partner for a better life. Shortchanging these efforts would increase the suffering and chaos of our world, undercut our long-term security, and dull the conscience of our country. I urge members of Congress to serve the interests of America by showing the compassion of America. Our country must also remain on the offensive against terrorism here at home. The enemy has not lost the desire or capability to attack us. Fortunately, this nation has superb professionals in law enforcement, intelligence, the military, and homeland security. These men and women are dedicating their lives to protecting us all, and they deserve our support and our thanks. They also deserve the same tools they already use to fight drug trafficking and organized crime, so I ask you to reauthorize the Patriot Act.
This is a matter which some members of the president's own party on Capitol Hill object to, reauthorization of the Patriot Act, a very important priority for him.
It is said that prior to the attacks of September the 11th, our government failed to connect the dots of the conspiracy. We now know that two of the hijackers in the United States placed telephone calls to al-Qaeda operatives overseas. But we did not know about their plans until it was too late. So to prevent another attack, based on authority given to me by the Constitution and by statute, I have authorized a Terrorist Surveillance Program to aggressively pursue the international communications of suspected al-Qaeda operatives and affiliates to and from America. Previous presidents have used the same constitutional authority I have, and federal courts have approved the use of that authority. Appropriate members of Congress have been kept informed. The Terrorist Surveillance Program has helped prevent terrorist attacks. It remains essential to the security of America. If there are people inside our country who are talking with al-Qaeda, we want to know about it because we will not sit back and wait to be hit again.
This, of course, is a very controversial matter. Many Democrats in the Congress have been very critical of the president not consulting the secret court that was established to review security surveillance requests and doing this claiming constitutional authority. It's a matter of forthcoming hearings on Capitol Hill.
In all these areas, from the disruption of terror networks to victory in Iraq, to the spread of freedom and hope in troubled regions, we need the support of our friends and allies. To draw that support, we must always be clear on our principles and willing to act. The only alternative to American leadership is a dramatically more dangerous and anxious world. Yet we also choose to lead because it is a privilege to serve the values that gave us birth. American leaders, from Roosevelt to Truman to Kennedy to Reagan, rejected isolation and retreat because they knew that America is always more secure when freedom is on the march. Our own generation is in a long war against a determined enemy, a war that will be fought by presidents of both parties who will need steady bipartisan support from the Congress. And tonight I ask for yours. Together, let us protect our country, support the men and women who defend us, and lead this world toward freedom.
And with that, the president is now going to address more domestic and economic matters in the State of the Union address.
Here at home, America also has a great opportunity. We will build the prosperity of our country by strengthening our economic leadership in the world. Our economy is healthy and vigorous and growing faster than other major industrialized nations. In the last 2.5 years, America has created 4.6 million new jobs, more than Japan and the European Union combined. Even in the face of higher energy prices and natural disasters, the American people have turned in an economic performance that is the envy of the world. The American economy is preeminent, but we cannot afford to be complacent. In a dynamic world economy, we are seeing new competitors like China and India, and this creates uncertainty, which makes it easier to feed people's fears. So we're seeing some old temptations return. Protectionists want to escape competition, pretending that we can keep our high standard of living while walling off our economy. Others say that the government needs to take a larger role in directing the economy, centralizing more power in Washington and increasing taxes. We hear claims that immigrants are somehow bad for the economy, even though this economy could not function without them. These are forms of economic retreat, and they lead in the same direction, toward a stagnant and second-rate economy. Tonight, I will set out a better path, an agenda for a nation that competes with confidence an agenda that will raise standards of living and generate new jobs. Americans should not fear our economic future because we intend to shape it. Keeping America competitive begins with keeping our economy growing. And our economy grows when Americans have more of their own money to spend, save, and invest. In the last 5 years, the tax relief you passed has left $880 billion in the hands of American workers, investors, small businesses, and families. And they have used it to help produce more than 4 years of uninterrupted economic growth. Yet the tax relief is set to expire in the next few years. If we do nothing, American families will face a massive tax increase they do not expect and will not welcome. Because America needs more than a temporary expansion, we need more than temporary tax relief. I urge the Congress to act responsibly and make the tax cuts permanent.
Some actual cheers there from the Republican side of the aisle, in addition to a standing ovation.
Keeping America competitive requires us to be good stewards of tax dollars. Every year of my presidency, we've reduced the growth of non-security discretionary spending. And last year, you passed bills that cut this spending. This year, my budget will cut it again and reduce or eliminate more than 140 programs that are performing poorly or not fulfilling essential priorities. By passing these reforms, we will save the American taxpayer another $14 billion next year and stay on track to cut the deficit in half by 2009. I am pleased that members of Congress are working on earmark reform because the federal budget has too many special interest projects. And we can tackle this problem together if you pass the line item veto.
Something President Reagan used to ask for every year, something the Congress was extremely unlikely to give him.
We must also confront the larger challenge of mandatory spending or entitlements. This year, the first of about 78 million baby boomers turned 60, including two of my dad's favorite people, me and President Clinton. This milestone is more than a personal crisis. It is a national challenge. The retirement of the baby boom generation will put unprecedented strains on the federal government. By 2030, spending for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid alone will be almost 60% of the entire federal budget. And that will present future Congresses with impossible choices: staggering tax increases, immense deficits, or deep cuts in every category of spending. Congress did not act last year on my proposal to save Social Security.
I think those are some Democrats cheering that they didn't act on the president's plan for partial privatization. And some spirited back and forth between
the
two parties.
Yet the rising cost of entitlements is a problem that is not going away. And every year we fail to act, the situation gets worse. So tonight I ask you to join me in creating a commission to examine the full impact of baby boom retirements on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. This commission should include members of Congress of both parties and offer bipartisan solutions. We need to put aside partisan politics and work together and get this problem solved.
bit of an olive branch there, calling for a commission now, bipartisan, to address the future of Social Security.
Keeping America competitive requires us to open more markets for all that Americans make and grow. One out of every five factory jobs in America is related to global trade, and we want people everywhere to buy American. With open markets and a level playing field, no one can outproduce or outcompete the American worker. Keeping America competitive requires an immigration system that upholds our laws, reflects our values, and serves the interests of our economy. Our nation needs orderly and secure borders. To meet this goal, we must have stronger immigration enforcement and border protection. And we must have a rational, humane guest worker program that rejects amnesty, allows temporary jobs for people who seek them legally, and reduces smuggling and crime at the border.
That guest worker program, a proposal of the president's, fairly controversial on Capitol Hill. We'll talk about that later.
Keeping America competitive requires affordable health care. Our government has a responsibility to provide health care for the poor and the elderly, and we are meeting that responsibility. For all Americans, we must confront the rising cost of care, strengthen the doctor-patient relationship, and help people afford the insurance coverage they need. We will make wider use of electronic records and other health information technology to help control costs and reduce dangerous medical errors. We will strengthen health savings accounts, making sure individuals and small business employees can buy insurance with the same advantages that people working for big businesses now get.
This is one of the favorite projects, proposals of the president, the expansion of the...
We will do more to make this coverage portable so workers can switch jobs without having to worry about losing their health insurance.
The expansion of health savings accounts.
And because lawsuits are driving many good doctors out of practice, leaving women in nearly 1,500 American counties without a single OBGYN, I ask the Congress to pass medical liability reform this year. Keeping America competitive requires affordable energy. And here we have a serious problem. America is addicted to oil, which is often imported from unstable parts of the world. The best way to break this addiction is through technology. Since 2001, we have spent nearly $10 billion to develop cleaner, cheaper, and more reliable alternative energy sources. And we are on the threshold of incredible advances. So tonight I announce the Advanced Energy Initiative, a 22% increase in clean energy research at the Department of Energy to push for breakthroughs in two vital areas. To change how we power our homes and offices, we will invest more in zero-emission coal-fired plants, revolutionary solar and wind technologies, and clean, safe nuclear energy. We must also change how we power our automobiles. We will increase our research in better batteries for hybrid and electric cars and in pollution-free cars that run on hydrogen. We will also fund additional research in cutting-edge methods of producing ethanol, not just from corn, but from wood chips and stalks or switchgrass. Our goal is to make this new kind of ethanol practical and competitive within 6 years. Breakthroughs on this and other new technologies will help us reach another great goal, to replace more than 75% of our oil imports from the Middle East by 2025. By applying the talent and technology of America, this country can dramatically improve our environment, move beyond a petroleum-based economy, and make our dependence on Middle Eastern oil a thing of the past. And to keep America competitive, one commitment is necessary above all. We must continue to lead the world in human talent and creativity. Our greatest advantage in the world has always been our educated, hardworking, ambitious people, and we're going to keep that edge. Tonight, I announced an American Competitiveness Initiative to encourage innovation throughout our economy and to give our nation's children a firm grounding in math and science. First, I propose to double the federal commitment to the most critical basic research programs in the physical sciences over the next 10 years. This funding will support the work of America's most creative minds as they explore promising areas such as nanotechnology and supercomputing and alternative energy sources. Second, I propose to make permanent the research and development tax credit to encourage bolder private sector initiative in technology. With more research in both the public and private sectors, we will improve our quality of life and ensure that America will lead the world in opportunity and innovation for decades to come. Third, we need to encourage children to take more math and science, and to make sure those courses are rigorous enough to compete with other nations. We've made a good start in the early grades with the No Child Left Behind Act, which is raising standards and lifting test scores across our country. Tonight, I propose to train 70,000 high school teachers to lead advanced placement courses in math and science, bring 30,000 math and science professionals to teach in classrooms, and give early help to students who struggle with math so they have a better chance at good, high-wage jobs. If we ensure that America's children succeed in life, they will ensure that America succeeds in the world.
That boost in teaching, the third component of what the President calls the American Competitiveness Initiative.
Preparing our nation to compete in the world is a goal that all of us can share. I urge you to support the American Competitiveness Initiative, and together we will show the world what the American people can achieve. America is a great force for freedom and prosperity. Yet our greatness is not measured in power or luxuries, but by who we are and how we treat one another. So we strive to be a compassionate, decent, hopeful society. In recent years, America has become a more hopeful nation. Violent crime rates have fallen to their lowest levels since the 1970s. Welfare cases have dropped by more than half over the past decade. Drug use among youth is down 19% since 2001. There are fewer abortions in America than at any point in the last three decades, and the number of children born to teenage mothers has been falling for a dozen years in a row. These gains are evidence of a quiet transformation, a revolution of conscience in which a rising generation is finding that a life of personal responsibility is a life of fulfillment. Government has played a role. Wise policies such as welfare reform, drug education, and support for abstinence and adoption have made a difference in the character of our country. And everyone here tonight, Democrat and Republican, has a right to be proud of this record. Yet many Americans, especially parents, still have deep concerns about the direction of our culture and the health of our most basic institutions. They're concerned about unethical conduct by public officials and discouraged by activist courts that try to redefine marriage. They worry about children in our society who need direction in love, and about fellow citizens still displaced by natural disaster, and about suffering caused by treatable diseases. As we look at these challenges, we must never give in to the belief that America is in decline or that our culture is doomed to unravel. The American people know better than that. We have proven the pessimists wrong before, and we will do it again. A hopeful society depends on courts that deliver equal justice under the law. The Supreme Court now has two superb new members on its bench, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Sam Alito.
They are both present in the chamber, seated up front, and there's a standing ovation for the two new members of the court.
I thank the Senate for confirming both of them. I will continue to nominate men and women who understand that judges must be servants of the law and not legislate from the bench. Today marks the official retirement of a very special American. For 24 years of faithful service to our nation, the United States is grateful to Justice Sandra Day O'Connor.
And a big round of applause for the retiring Associate Justice, who is now succeeded by Justice Alito on the United States Supreme Court.
A hopeful society has institutions of science and medicine that do not cut ethical corners and that recognize the matchless value of every life. Tonight, I ask you to pass legislation to prohibit the most egregious abuses of medical research, human cloning in all its forms, creating or implanting embryos for experiments, creating human-animal hybrids, and buying, selling, or patenting human embryos. Human life is a gift from our Creator, and that gift should never be discarded, devalued, or put up for sale. A hopeful society expects elected officials to uphold the public trust. Honorable people in both parties are working on reforms to strengthen the ethical standards of Washington. I support your efforts. Each of us has made a pledge to be worthy of public responsibility, and that is a pledge we must never forget, never dismiss, and never betray.
President, addressing this issue, both as the House has its own ethics problems, centering on former Majority Leader Tom DeLay, but also as members of his own White House staff
are under indictment. We renew the promise of our institutions. Let us also show the character of America in our compassion and care for one another. A hopeful society gives special attention to children who lack direction in love. Through the Helping America's Youth Initiative, we're encouraging caring adults to get involved in the life of a child. And this good work is being led by our First Lady, Laura Bush.
This is WILL Urbana.
And everyone is applauding the First Lady, who stands to acknowledge the applause and takes her seat.
This year we will add resources to encourage young people to stay in school so more of America's youth can raise their sights and achieve their dreams. A hopeful society comes to the aid of fellow citizens in times of suffering and emergency and stays at it until they're back on their feet. So far, the federal government has committed $85 billion to the people of the Gulf Coast and New Orleans. We're removing debris and repairing highways and rebuilding stronger levees. We're providing business loans and housing assistance. Yet as we meet these immediate needs, we must also address deeper challenges that existed before the storm arrived. In New Orleans and in other places, many of our fellow citizens have felt excluded from the promise of our country. The answer is not only temporary relief, but schools that teach every child, and job skills that bring upward mobility, and more opportunities to own a home and start a business. As we recover from a disaster, let us also work for the day when all Americans are protected by justice, equal in hope, and rich in opportunity. A hopeful society acts boldly to fight diseases like HIV/AIDS, which can be prevented and treated and defeated. More than 1 million Americans live with HIV, and half of all AIDS cases occur among African Americans. I ask Congress to reform and reauthorize the Ryan White Act and provide new funding to states so we end the waiting list for AIDS medicines in America. We will also lead a nationwide effort, working closely with African-American churches and faith-based groups to deliver rapid HIV tests to millions, end the stigma of AIDS, and come closer to the day when there are no new infections in America. Fellow citizens, we've been called to leadership in a period of consequence. We've entered a great ideological conflict we did nothing to invite. We see great changes in science and commerce that will influence all our lives. Sometimes it can seem that history is turning in a wide arc toward an unknown shore. Yet the destination of history is determined by human action, and every great movement of history comes to a point of choosing. Lincoln could have accepted peace at the cost of disunity and continued slavery. Martin Luther King could have stopped at Birmingham or at Selma and achieved only half a victory over segregation. The United States could have accepted the permanent division of Europe and been complicit in the oppression of others. Today, having come far in our own historical journey, we must decide, will we turn back or finish well? Before history is written down in books, it is written in courage. Like Americans before us, we will show that courage, and we will finish well. We will lead freedom's advance. We will compete and excel in the global economy. We will renew the defining moral commitments of this land. And so we move forward, optimistic about our country, faithful to its cause, and confident of the victories to come. May God bless America.
We will renew the defining moral commitments of this land. So says President George W. Bush near the conclusion of this, his State of the Union address in 2006. I'm Robert Siegel in Washington. I'm joined by NPR's Mara Liasson and also by our guest political observers. We can hear from all of them right now. In a few minutes, we will hear the Democratic response to the State of the Union address to be given by the newly elected and inaugurated governor of Virginia, Tim Kaine, a new voice for the Democrats, giving the formal response to the State of the Union this year. We heard the president talk about the long-term goal of our nation, the end of tyranny in all the world. And he spoke of continuing the fight against terrorism, the war in Iraq. He defended the domestic surveillance that he ordered to be conducted by the NSA. And then he listed a number of domestic objectives, including an initiative for greater research and science education. Mara Liasson, what struck you as noteworthy about the State of the Union?
Well, what struck me is by far I thought the stronger part of the speech was the first half, maybe even more than half, on foreign policy. And he repeated his arguments about the NSA program, and he used the same kind of ringing rhetoric about freedom and ending tyranny that he's used in the past. He laid down a challenge to Egypt and Saudi Arabia to open up paths to peaceful opposition, to reduce the appeal of radicalism, and all that he's done before, but I thought that was the strongest part of the speech. I actually was surprised about the domestic part. I thought there would be more meat on it than there was. Even though I had expected modest proposals, I didn't expect them to be this modest, I guess, or this modestly explained.
You were expecting more in the way of a health care proposal,
yeah, I was, if not details, because that's what you don't expect in a State of the Union address, at least a little bit more oomph to them. And that I actually found surprising. There isn't that much there. You know, he certainly gave a nod to ethics reforms and said that he supports the effort to do something about earmarks, which are the pork barrel projects that Congress is trying to figure out what they want to do about.
But on Social Security, yeah, though, he said it's time for a bipartisan commission. We've had bipartisan commissions, and I think the mantra of the past year was that time has come and gone.
He tried that and failed, and now there's a bipartisan commission. That's kind of paying lip services to keeping the idea alive of doing something about entitlements. But and even on energy, now he did say something that was quite striking. America is addicted to oil. Sounds like Tom Friedman, who's been writing a lot about this in the New York Times. But the way to break that addiction is an increase in clean energy research and more nuclear power plants and more research into ethanol. Not a huge comprehensive energy independence program.
And setting a target that was by 2025, reduced dependence on Middle Eastern oil by, I think, 75%. Well, joining us from our bureau in New York is Rich Lowry, who's editor of the National Review. Rich, what did you think?
Well, a couple things. One, I think one factor that has dogged Bush's presidency is that he has seemed in a lot of ways to be the bad news president, the feel-bad presidency. Whenever you see the guy on TV, you kind of think to yourself, oh, gosh, what is it now? Is it a recession? Is it a terrorist attack? Is it, you know, a difficult insurgency in Iraq? And what he tried to do in this speech thematically throughout was to put a more optimistic interpretation on events and say, yes, there are these various challenges facing the country, but we can unite and together overcome them. So it was an attempt to be a feel-good speech in difficult times. And I agree with Maura that this has always been the case with Bush speeches since 9/11. The real emotional punch was in that first part that had to do with the war on terror and foreign policy and the war on Iraq. And I thought the most effective lines in the speech politically were those directed at what you perhaps can call the MRTHA Democrats, those Democrats who are toying with the idea of an exit strategy or some sort of timeline for a more or less immediate withdrawal. And he had those very harsh words where he said, hindsight is not wisdom and second guessing is not a strategy.
Yes, he said that after welcoming the council of members on the Hill, and then he set those boundaries to the debate, which is discussion of where we are at right now, yes, but not bickering over how we got there. E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post.
That struck me very much. He was a uniter and a divider at the same time and within two pages. He spoke he spoke of a civil tone. We must act in a spirit of goodwill. And then two pages later, the olive branch becomes a big wooden club. He attacks defeatism that refuses to acknowledge anything but failure. Hindsight alone is not wisdom, and second-guessing is not a strategy. What struck me about the foreign policy stuff is it was stronger than all these little domestic initiatives, and I think the White House made a mistake overselling health care because there clearly, as Maura said, isn't very much here. But it was actually a rather familiar set of arguments that we've heard now on Iraq and terror for the last couple of months. He clearly wants to move from a specific discussion of the problems and failures in Iraq and other aspects of his approach into a very general attack on vague ideas that sound terrible, isolation and retreat. He wants to tell conservatives he's not a big spender, but I was really struck by this phrase. He said, we have reduced the growth of non-security discretionary spending. Now, that's strange.
That takes entitlements out, and then it takes
almost everything.
That takes debt service out of the budget.
That is cutting the salami really, really thin. And I think, you know, since spending and deficits are actually up. And as you said, Robert, this bipartisan commission, I mean, why didn't he do that in the first place? He tried to dictate his own solution to Social Security. His political capital is gone, and I think this is the bailout.
Rich Lowry, what do you say to that?
Well, yeah, obviously. A bipartisan commission is always a bailout. That's pretty much what it is by definition. And I also was mostly overwhelmed by the domestic portions of the speech. And
Overwhelmed, did you say?
Underwhelmed.
Sorry. Underwhelmed, yes.
Very, very underwhelmed, especially the energy stuff. First of all, what does it mean to reduce our dependency by 75% of Middle Eastern oil? If you look at our top, the top five countries that export oil to us, the top is Canada, then comes Mexico, then Saudi Arabia, granted problematic, and then you have Nigeria and Venezuela. So what, are we just going to stop the Saudi portion of those imports? That doesn't make a lot of sense. And if you look at what he's proposing for his energy policy, it's just more subsidies. This is exactly what we saw in the energy bill passed last year, which was just a dog's breakfast of subsidies to every possible energy interest in the country. And President Bush referred to the fact that since 2001, we spent, you know, $10 billion on various forms of energy research. Well, what have we gotten from it? Exactly nothing. And that's probably what will come of this additional spending he's proposing as well.
Did any of you think that the president advanced the case for what he calls the terrorist surveillance program or the domestic surveillance? Mara?
Well, I actually think that the president has now this is the power of the bully pulpit. He has been giving speech after speech after speech about this. And I think just the sheer amount of attention he can command is getting him somewhere. I mean, he has said over and over and over again that this program is legal. That I think he said the appropriate members of Congress were briefed. What he's referring to there is it's the gang of eight. Eight members of Congress were briefed, and that it's essential, and that if he had done this before, it could have prevented 9/11. To prevent another attack, I'm doing this. I have the authority in the Constitution. I mean, I don't think he made a new argument tonight, but he continued the basic tack that the administration has been taking, which is it's legal. We told Congress about it. And if you are against this program for any reason, then you are against the notion that we should be trying to listen in on conversations with al-Qaeda. So in that sense, every time he gets an opportunity to stand up before a huge audience and say this, that's helping him.
Yeah, and Moore is right. This is clearly the election issue. It's, you know, if you don't want to get blown up, vote Republican, and those squishy civil libertarian Democrats don't want to let me do what I want to do. I think one of the critical things in this debate is what do moderate and libertarian Republicans have to say about this over in the coming months? It was striking on the Patriot Act that a group of libertarian Republicans, not moderates, but libertarians like John Sununu in New Hampshire, four of them in particular, held up the bill and said, we're willing to pass most of this. We want some protections. It's going to be very interesting to see if that group of Republicans and perhaps Senator Spector say, wait a minute, you can be for fighting terrorism, but some of these things are highly questionable.
But it's interesting on the Patriot Act, what happened in the end is the moderates came back into the fold. You had this interesting group of Republicans that were the libertarian kind of conservatives plus the moderates, but in the end, the moderates were willing to give up their objections, and you were left with the Sununus and the Craigs kind of
who are still out there.
And but very interesting. Yeah. It was almost as if Sununu shamed some of the moderates, because when there was a letter at the end of the year, a lot of them joined with Sununu. Yeah. There were about seven or eight Republicans that said, "Let's postpone this and see if we can work this out."
Rich Lowry, is this still an intramural Republican problem, or will the party close ranks around the Patriot Act?
Oh, I think the Patriot Act. The differences have really been ground down to fairly minor things, and there'll be a renewal where the White House gets almost everything it wanted. On the NSA program, look, they just think this is a winner for them. They think it's a great classic wedge issue where you're going to divide Democrats and independents among themselves and get some of them to support this program. And if you take just one sentence defense of this program from President Bush, if people are talking to Al-Qaeda, we want to know about it. That's something that's going to have resonance with most people who are listening to this speech or considering this program. So, and also, clearly, you know, the way it's defined is going to be a big part of this, and that's why he's calling it a terrorist surveillance program.
As Mara Liasson said, the president has been saying many of these things in the many public appearances he's been making in recent weeks. But we should point out the difference in scale here, that this is an event when not just a national radio network or two, but all of the national television networks, all of the all-news cable channels are carrying the president's address. It really compares only with, when you come down to it, election night for everybody carrying a political event all at once. And so the number of people who are hearing or seeing these arguments made is much, much larger than those who might either see a clip one day on the news or possibly tune into a live broadcast on CNN.
And that's why that part, the foreign policy part, the arguments about the Patriot Act and NSA, as E.J. said, this is going to be the heart of the reelection message from the Republicans. Karl Rove laid it out very clearly for everyone a couple of weeks ago. That's why this is really the important part of the speech, because that's the opportunity that the president wanted to take tonight. Health savings accounts are just not as important.
You know what's interesting, Robert? You're right, of course, that there's no audience like this. But with as many options as people have, it'll be very interesting to see what the ratings of this are compared to earlier speeches, because some people might be watching basketball. Some people might be watching reruns on other cable network. And I think it'll be a measure of where the president stands if the ratings are down substantially. One other point, if I could raise, and I'd be curious what Rich thought about this. I was struck that the language on Iran was very, very mild. This was not sort of, we are going to war. This was not really threatening language. You know, the regime, he said, yes, the regime in that country sponsors terrorists. That must come to an end. Defying the world, Iran is defying the world with its nuclear ambitions. But then he closed by talking about his hopes one day for a free and democratic Iran. He is not ratcheting up the rhetoric on Iran, at least if this speech is an indication.
Rich Lowry?
No, I think that's right. He didn't really move the ball down the field rhetorically much at all. And I think that reflects the general strategy.
A democratic response to President Bush on behalf of my Commonwealth, my fellow Democratic governors, and the Democratic Party.
This is Tim Kaine of Virginia.
I worked as a missionary when I was a young man, and I learned to measure my life by the difference I can make in someone else's life. Coretta Scott King embodied that value, and tonight as a nation we mourn her passing. Our faith and values teach us that there's no higher calling than serving others. Our federal government should serve the American people. But that mission is frustrated by this administration's poor choices and bad management. Families in the Gulf Coast see that as they wait to rebuild their lives. Americans who lose their jobs see that as they look to rebuild their careers. And our soldiers in Iraq see that as they try to rebuild a nation. As Americans, we do great things when we work together. Some of our leaders in Washington seem to have forgotten that. I want to offer some good news tonight. There is a better way. In Virginia and other states, we're moving ahead by focusing on service, competent management, and results. It's all about bringing people together to find common sense solutions to our common problems. That's how we in Virginia earn the ranking of America's best managed state. You know, no matter what political philosophy you hold or what state you call home, you have a right to expect that your government can deliver results. When there's a crime or fire, you expect that police and firefighters have the tools to respond. When there's a natural disaster, you expect a well-managed response. When you send your children to school, you expect them to be prepared for success, and you have a right to expect government to be fiscally responsible, pay the bills, and live within its means. Tonight we heard the president again call to make his tax policies permanent, despite his administration's failure to manage our staggering national debt. Over the past 5 years, we've gone from huge surpluses to massive deficits. Now, no parent makes their child pay the mortgage bill. Why should we allow this administration to pass down the bill for its reckless spending to our children and grandchildren? There's a better way. 2 years ago in Virginia, Democrats and Republicans worked together to reform our budget. By focusing on results, we were able to keep the budget balanced, preserve our strong credit rating, and protect the essential services that families rely on: education, health care, law enforcement. States all across this country are doing this right now as the federal government falls further and further into debt. Think about what's occurring in education. The administration's No Child Left Behind Act is wreaking havoc on local school districts. Despite the insistence of Democrats in Congress that the program should be funded as promised, the administration has opposed full funding and is refusing to let states try innovative alternatives. Now the Republican leadership in Washington is actually cutting billions of dollars from the student loan programs that serve working families, helping to get their children through college. There's a better way. Last year, governors from across the country worked together in a bipartisan fashion to reform the senior year of high school to make it serve our students better. Many states are working to make high-quality pre-kindergarten accessible to every family. Congressional Democrats have a plan to educate 100,000 new engineers, scientists, and mathematicians in the next 4 years. And in Virginia, Democrats and Republicans alike work together to make record investments in education, the results, more accredited schools, better student test scores. Look what's happening to health care. Skyrocketing costs are hurting small businesses and pushing millions of working Americans into the ranks of the uninsured. The White House has made efforts to cut Medicaid funds for our most vulnerable citizens. Our seniors were promised that the new federal Medicare drug plan would make it easier and cheaper to obtain their medication. Instead, many have fallen victim to the program's poor planning. They find getting their medicine to be more complex, more expensive, and less reliable. There's a better way. Healthcare reforms have to focus on making the system serve consumers better. Many states, following the lead of Illinois, have set up simple ways to help seniors purchase safe, American-made prescription drugs from other countries at a fraction of the price they would pay here. And the administration actually fought against that Democratic effort. In Virginia, we've worked to provide health insurance coverage for nearly 140,000 children who weren't covered 4 years ago. And Republicans and Democrats alike have come together to fight the administration's efforts to slash Medicaid and push more costs onto the states. The president called again tonight for our commitment to win the war on terror and to support our troops. Every American embraces those goals. We must defeat those who attack and kill innocent people. While the images of the World Trade Center are seared in the minds of all Americans, so too are the memories of those who died on sacred ground here in Virginia in the attack on the Pentagon. Our commitment to winning the war on terror compels us to ask this question. Are the president's policies the best way to win this war? We now know that the American people were given inaccurate information about reasons for invading Iraq. We now know that our troops in Iraq were not given the best body armor or the best intelligence. We now know the administration wants to cut tens of thousands of troops from the Army Reserves and the National Guard at the very time that we're facing new and dangerous threats. And we now know that the administration wants to further reduce military and veterans' benefits. There's a better way. Working together, we have to give our troops the tools they need to win the war on terror. And we can do it without sacrificing the liberty that we've sent our troops abroad to defend. Our support has to begin here at home. That's why we in Virginia, Democrats and Republicans, have reformed and enhanced our Department of Veterans Services to help our veterans and their family members access the federal benefits that they've earned. And we're working to provide state reenlistment bonuses to honor those Virginians who stay in service to Commonwealth and country. When it comes to energy, Americans are using more than ever, paying more for it, and are more dependent on the Middle East than ever before. There's a better way. Last summer, I joined Democrats in Washington and in other states and called on oil companies to share in our sacrifice and return some of their record-breaking excess profits. Democrats at both the state and national levels are leading the way on energy reforms, calling for greater public investments for alternative advanced energy technologies. These investments will promote energy independence, boost the nation's economy, create jobs, and strengthen national security. The failure of the federal government to implement and enforce a rational immigration policy has resulted in a confusing patchwork of state and local efforts. Of course, we should welcome those who seek to lawfully join and contribute to our American family, and we must. But at the same time, we have to ensure that our homeland defense efforts begin with consistent federal action to protect our borders. The administration is falling behind in other critical areas: preserving the environment, keeping our workplaces safe, protecting family farms, keeping jobs in America. Our communities are then left to deal with the challenges and the consequences of these federal failures without a reliable partner. But we managed to find a better way. The better way is to focus on service. It's about measuring what we do in terms of real results for real people. It's not about partisanship or political spin. It's about protecting the rights endowed by our Creator, fulfilling the principle of equality set out in the Declaration of Independence, and ensuring that the light of liberty shines on every American. If we want to replace the division that's gripping our nation's capital, we need a change. Democrats are leading that reform effort, working to restore honesty and openness to our government, working to replace a culture of partisanship and cronyism with an ethic of service and results. Our greatest need is for America to heal its partisan wounds and become one people. You know, those are words that Thomas Jefferson expressed after he was elected president, and they ring as true today as they did in 1800. Tonight, we pray earnestly and humbly for that healing and for the day when service returns again as the better way to a new national politics. We ask all Americans to join us in that effort, because together, America can do better. Thank you for listening, and God bless the United States of America.
It's Tim Kaine, the new governor of Virginia, offering the Democratic Party's official response to President Bush's speech and using the refrain, "There's a better way," which he said to many of the points that the president has made. Governor Kaine, by the way, began by saying that he had been a missionary in Honduras, and that's a theme that he struck often in an interesting campaign last fall, in which he was elected as a Democrat who spoke often of his religious faith. He was speaking in response to a speech in which the president pledged the United States to continue the fight for freedom around the world and to continue to prosecute the war effort in Iraq. I'm Robert Siegel, and you're listening to special coverage of the President's State of the Union Address from NPR News. Joining me now are NPR correspondents whose beats have been addressed in the State of the Union this evening. They include John Hendren, who is NPR's Pentagon correspondent, Jackie Northam, our national security correspondent, and our health policy correspondent, Julie Rovner, still with us, of course, is our national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. And Julie Rovner first. Let's take the domestic stuff in that. We thought we were getting a big picture on health care earlier. The White House seemed to be telling folks that.
Well, there wasn't that much in the speech, but there was quite a bit that the White House put out in some background documents. What we basically know is that the president is going to make a full court press for a dramatic expansion of health savings accounts. Now, if you've never heard of health savings accounts, you're not alone. They have been growing rapidly, but there's about 3 million people now who have them out of 160 million people with employer-provided health insurance. And the president has really sort of taken some older ideas and expanded them. For instance, for a long time, he'd proposed tax credits to help low-income people purchase insurance. Now these tax credits would only be for them to purchase insurance that would go with these health savings accounts. Uh-huh. So there's a variety of ways it would let employers put more money into the health savings accounts. Basically, the idea is that people should have more responsibility for their own health care choices, should be spending their own money, and that will bring health spending down. There are not very many economists who actually agree with that. They think that individuals could probably save money with these health savings accounts, but overall, the national health bill would probably not come down, and that's because the vast majority of people don't spend that much money on health care. The top 5% of people account for about half of all health spending in the U.S.
But this is continuing a real philosophical position of this administration, witnessed last year in the Social Security proposal, which is individuals looking out for themselves, being responsible for themselves, making their own decisions.
This is very much a piece of what the president likes to talk about is the ownership society. That basically, in a speech earlier this week, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, famous for the health reform plan of her husband, said that she can sum up the president's health plan in three words: on your own. And that's actually fairly apt, that basically rather than having shared risk, you will be taking your own risk and deciding, saving your own money and spending your own money.
Before you go, Julia, I want you to remark on the dog that didn't bark. Big health care initiative wasn't mentioned in the speech tonight.
Yes, the president really was expected to take a victory lap on the new Medicare prescription drug benefit, and he did not mention the word. I suspect it's entirely possible he would have been booed. It's gotten off to a very rocky start, and a lot of members, Democrats and Republicans, are getting a lot of complaint. Also, this is basically the way he wants to move the rest of the health care system to more private choices, and it's not exactly a great advertisement, at least a month in.
Julie Rovner, thank you very much. On to John Hendren, our Pentagon man here. A lot of talk about Iraq, of course, and discussions of how everybody, of course, wants U.S. troops to come home. That decision, the president said, will be made by commanders in the field, not by politicians in Washington.
He faces a lot of challenges on Iraq because the public, by and large, is increasingly opposed to the war, and yet, by and large, wants the U.S. troops to stay there until they complete their mission, and yet they're pressuring to get those troops out as fast as they possibly can. He raised the specter of Afghanistan and talked about how things were going fairly positively there, but even there are challenges where the sort of suicide bomb tactics that you see in Iraq are migrating over to Afghanistan. And that public support is key, as we've learned from Vietnam. I mean, first there was the public support for the war that declined, and then later on that support for maintaining the troops there evaporated as well. So he had a goal here, I'm sure, of trying to persuade the public to stick it out a little longer. There's a high bar for doing that, and I would be surprised if he changed a lot of minds with the ideas that he had reiterated before.
Do you think commanders in the field actually will make the decisions as to how many troops come home?
Well, critics who have recently left the military will tell you that the commanders on the field are intimidated, and they don't want to be passing up news that they know the Pentagon and the Bush administration don't want to hear. Paul Bremer, the recently departed administrator for Iraq, said he asked Rumsfeld for more troops and was told no.
More. Jackie Northam covers national security for us and the subject of the terrorism surveillance program. Domestic surveillance was a major point of this speech, and the president defended it, said it was legal, has the right under the Constitution.
Right, and this is, I guess, where we start talking about truth squatting here, because that is something that really hasn't been settled. Over the past few weeks, the administration has come out and says that the president does have the constitutional authority to authorize this sort of domestic spying. They used the new term that they've come up, terrorist surveillance program, which everybody else seems to call domestic spying. And, this is the first step to trying to settle this, of course. This comes less than a week from now when there's Senate hearings on this to try and find out if really he does have the constitutional authority. So he did put it in there as a state of fact, but we'll see.
He can't be stopped, can he? I mean, if he asserts the authority, apart from impeachment, is there some way that the Congress could end this program?
Well, I mean, again, the first step of that is these hearings right now. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say what's going to happen. So far, the president has a lot of his policies on handling the war on terrorism, and this would be part of that, have gotten a wide berth. He's got away with it. But over the past year, since his last address a year ago, there's been a lot of controversy, a lot of debates, things like should we or do we torture prisoners to get information, intelligence. Guantanamo is another thing, another way that the administration is handling the war on terrorism. That really is starting to have a negative impact on his poll numbers.
John Hendren and Julie, Thank you, Julie. I know Julie Robner. Thank you. It's been a long night. Thank you all very much, because we're going to hear from some members of the Senate right now and what they expect to happen now about the issues raised by the president in his State of the Union address. And we're joined first by Republican Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, who is on the line with us. Welcome to the program once again, Senator McConnell.
Good evening.
Some of our earlier commentators thought that the issue of domestic surveillance and whether your point of view is that this is a good way to fight terrorism or whether this is an infringement of civil liberties is going to be a big litmus test political issue for 2006. Do you agree?
I agree. I think it's a big issue in the 2006 elections. I listened to the commentators who were on just before us. I don't know what planet they're living on, but the American people are overwhelmingly concerned about preventing another attack here on the homeland. People do indeed remember 9/11. The surveys indicate that once Americans understand, A, that the president strongly believes he's on sound ground legally, and B, the terrorism surveillance program is designed at intercepting conversations between people in the United States and suspected al-Qaeda members overseas, they overwhelmingly support the program. It appears as if there's no legislation needed. The president believes he's fully authorized to do what he's doing. Even the critics here in Congress say they're in favor of it. They just want to pass some law further defining that he can do what they say they're in favor of him doing. So I think this will be a big issue. That plus not weakening the Patriot Act. We're going to have to pass another short-term extension here in the next few days because the largely Democratic group has been filibustering extension of the Patriot Act, which is another very important post-9/11 tool.
But the top of the agenda here, as you see it, is all about national security, terrorism,
right.
Iraq, Afghanistan.
Right. That's what you and I have been discussing. That certainly is the biggest issue. The American people are concerned about that.
No, I want to ask you a hypothetical question about surveillance.
Yeah, sure.
I'm a journalist. A group that my government regards as terrorist in law has just been elected the majority party in the Palestinian territories.
Mm-hmm.
If I interview them, if I talk to them, does that open me up to surveillance? Should we assume that I'm talking to a terrorist? I mean, does the president have the inherent authority to surveil my conversation?
Well, the president believes he has the inherent authority to listen in to people who are in conversations with al-Qaeda overseas.
That's a very narrow. You're saying that's narrowly only about al-Qaeda, not about other terrorist groups.
That's my understanding of the program, yes.
And have you felt that as a member of the Senate, your branch of government was adequately briefed on this program?
The leaders of the House and Senate on a bipartisan basis were briefed on the program. I think if the president were not doing this, the same people who are criticizing him for doing it now would be criticizing him for not doing it because they would claim that he would not have been able to connect the dots after the next attack. They would be saying, where were you, Mr. President? You were asleep at the switch. You were not employing every technique you could employ in order to protect us from future attacks.
Senator McConnell, thank you very much for talking to us once again. We're going to hear from the senior Democratic member of the Senate Intelligence Committee. You may have a different take on that issue, Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia.
Hi.
You don't think the president has the authority to do that?
I think it's as yet unclear, but I think it's tremendously important that it get resolved. A lot of outside groups, the Congressional Research Service being the one that comes to mind, it's unclear. And what I think is tremendously important for Americans, if it is possible that this is a very wide net program and that a lot of people are being listened to, that they know that what the president's doing is, in fact, legal and that it is being undergoing oversight. See, the great problem that you were just discussing with Mitch, he talked about the leaders of the two bodies. Actually, they very rarely show up for the briefings. It's usually just I'm the one Democrat in the Senate, and Pat Roberts is the one Republican, and then there's one Republican, one Democrat in the House, and that is it.
It's a group of four, not typically.
It's the gang of four, and it really, on something which is so massive, I think it's really important that that the intelligence committees have oversight on this.
The president, at his biggest annual bully pulpit here, has made his case before the American people. Are you concerned that if the Democratic Party runs as the party of concerns about civil liberties instead of the party about concerns about conspiracies to conduct terrorism, that you could come out the loser on this issue?
In a very odd way, what I need to say to you is that my responsibility here in the Senate is to make sure that things are being done in a proper fashion. Mm-hmm. I think that we do need to be listening in on all contacts from America abroad that involve somebody who might be suspected of having a terrorist connection. I think it's very important that we listen.
How about my hypothetical call to Hamas?
Yes, you know, I think that it's unclear, in fact, as to whether that would be included or not, because there's some fudge lines at the end of the description of who can be listened to. It's not just purely al-Qaeda. It could be those we're associated with or whatever. I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. But what is missing is oversight. By law, the Senate Intelligence Committee, the House Intelligence Committee are required in closed session, in highly secret session, to hear what is going on, who is being listened to, how many, are there any calls being made from one person in America to another person in America? Do we know that for sure, that that's not happening? Are those who are deemed to be innocent and not involved in any way, are they being deleted from the program or are they not? At this point, we don't know those answers. So it's not a constitutional crisis. I don't criticize the president anyway. I'm glad that he's going ahead with a pursuit of potential terrorism. But, you know, as they say, as Sandra Day O'Connor said, it's not a blank check. It's not an open check to do whatever you want. There are rules. There are laws. The president has to operate within those laws, and he has to be under oversight. That is his intelligence programs.
The president says that the law in question was written before any of the current communications technologies were in use, and it's antiquated.
Well, but you see, that really feeds into a much more open discussion of that he's going ahead and using that. He referred to previous presidents that had done this, and yes, it was true, but it was under entirely different circumstances. Now it's not state versus state terrorism. It's individual cells, which may be here, there, yonder, wherever, and people have to be very careful of that.
Senator Rockefeller, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's Jay Rockefeller, Democrat of West Virginia, and the senior Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, talking with us about what was said this evening by President Bush. Now a Democratic leader from the other chamber, from the House, Nancy Pelosi, Democratic minority leader. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'd like you to ask you, last year at this time, we were all talking about Social Security.
Aye.
This year, the president has proposed a bipartisan commission to look into Social Security and see how the problem of entitlement should be fixed. Are you game? Do you accept it?
Well, I believe that it's necessary for there to be bipartisanship and addressing entitlements, but I don't know what the president is proposing. You know, frequently we hear him say one thing in a speech, and then when we see the nuts and bolts of it, it's something else. But I'd be happy to talk with the president about how we can work together to address the entitlement challenge. The president didn't want to work in a cooperative way last year, and we had to defeat him on his Social Security privatization plan by going outside of Washington with 1,000 town hall meetings and the American people recognizing how harmful that was to their pension security.
What if he has something in mind akin to what was done previously by bipartisan groups on the Hill to come up with new rates, new ceilings?
Well, the fact is on all of this, the model for us is Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan. And in 1983, they came forward to address the issues facing Social Security, and they made it solvent for 70 years until 2052. Social Security will be paying 100% of its benefits. But this goes to a larger issue, not just of the entitlements. It's just about what the president says and the rhetoric of his speech being quite different from the reality of what we will see, for example, tomorrow in the president's budget. Democrats, before his speech, challenged him with an innovation agenda. He responded, embracing some of the principles of it, but his budget does not speak to the investments in education that are required, the investments in research and development, the investments in small business modernization, et cetera. So So again, what the president says is one thing. The deeds are quite another. And year in and year out, we've been hearing these grandiose statements, which are not met by a budget in order to make them happen.
So, one last point but before you go. The president seemed to be directly addressing the position of your colleague, Democrat Jack Murtha, who had called for getting ready to withdraw troops from Iraq much, much sooner.
Yeah.
The president is absolutely against that.
Yeah, well,
are the Democrats going to run on Jack Murtha's ideas next fall?
Democrats are going to run on what they believe the situation is in Iraq, and that is that this administration has grossly mismanaged both our entry into that war and the implementation of it.
He says that's hindsight and second-guessing.
No. Well, he may say that, but we all said it in advance. I said in advance there was no intelligence to support the threat that the president was proposing. I said that before we even took the vote on that. But that's neither here nor there. The point is how the president has mismanaged the war, how he's mismanaged Katrina, how he's mismanaged the budget, and getting back to your point on national security, the president has set up some straw men this evening with how he dealt with the war, how he dealt with isolationism and protectionism. Who's talking about that? Who's talking about that? But the president always resorts to fear, tries to define the issues in a way that are either he's either in denial or in the dark on, and Democrats will have to push back very firmly. We want bipartisanship. We want to get the job done for the American people, but we must say no when the president is not making the proper representation about what is going on here. We must end the middle-class squeeze, for example. The president doesn't even know it exists. He speaks so glowingly of what is happening in the economy, which is not a reflection, which is what is happening in households across America.
Representative Pelosi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nancy Pelosi, the House Democratic leader of the minority party in the House. And joining us from the Hill right now is our leader in the House, Andrea Seabrook, NPR congressional correspondent. Andrea, what was going on there today?
Well, you know, Robert, it was really interesting to watch the speech inside the House chamber. It's kind of hard to see on TV and even harder to hear on the radio, but there are many times when only Democrats or only Republicans gave the president a standing ovation. To give you an example, I was taking notes on a copy of the speech, and I have one part marked the feisty page. So for example, when the president said that Congress did not act on his Social Security proposal last year, Democrats jumped up in enthusiastic applause by themselves. But then a line later, when Mr. Bush said the problem with Social Security and other entitlement programs is not going away, Republicans jumped into a standing ovation, joined a few seconds later by a few Democrats. And so there were a couple of other moments when only Republicans applauded the president, when he urged Congress to pass medical liability reform, when he pushed making tax cuts permanent, when the president urged reauthorizing the Patriot Act, and when he spoke of his domestic surveillance program that you were just speaking to Mr. McConnell about. There were some times when Democrats stood alone in their ovation as well, when the president said health care must be affordable and when he said the economy can't function without immigrants. And, you know, to be fair, there were a few moments when both Republicans and Democrats seemed to jump with special enthusiasm together into a standing ovation. When Mr. Bush said America should reduce its dependence on Middle Eastern oil, when he said Congress should strengthen ethical standards in Washington, that's pretty much directly targeted at the Congress, and also when he said, interestingly, that the leaders of Hamas, which just won Palestinian elections, must recognize Israel and reject terrorism.
Andrea, on one other point, something happened on the Hill tonight involving Cindy Sheehan, the anti-war protester. And I wonder if you're aware of what was going on there and what happened.
I understand that she was arrested, but I don't know a whole lot more than that at this point. I don't know what she was doing. I can't confirm any of the details of that.
There was some talk earlier of a banner that someone thought she might have intended to enter the chamber and unfurl a banner, but we don't have that. Now then, Andrea, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
NPR's Andrea Seabrook on the Hill, which was the site this evening of President Bush's State of the Union address, and it was followed by a response offered by the Democratic Party, which chose this year a new face, and that is Governor Tim Kaine of Virginia, who spoke from Richmond. I'm Robert Siegel, and I'm joined by NPR's Mara Liasson and by our guest political observers E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of The National Review. Mara, let's have some summary thoughts here. A great speech, a good speech, a speech we can barely remember in 2 weeks.
I don't think it was a great speech, although it had some of the president's kind of signature great lines that I don't know if Michael Gerson wrote them, but he's the guy who writes them in the past that talk about history is turning in a wide arc toward an unknown shore. I mean, the president often has some poetry in his speeches, but I think this speech was a forceful distillation of his arguments on national security, on staying the course in Iraq, as opposed to the opponent that he wants to face, which is the cut-and-run crowd, as he's defined mm-hmm. them. The same thing on the NSA spying program. If you're not for this, or if you question its legality, then you are not for hunting al-Qaeda, and you're not for keeping America safe from terrorism. I think that was very strong. I think that this speech signals that the domestic agenda is going to be run by Congress this year. This is an election year. Members of Congress are going to be looking out for their own political fortunes. They're not tied as much to the president as they used to. And the fact that he hasn't given them this big, ambitious domestic agenda like he tried to do with Social Security last year suggests that in some senses on domestic issues, he'll be taking less of a leadership role with Congress. Of course, the opposite is true in foreign policy.
I want to hear what some of you think about one line that I flagged, perhaps because I've spent a lot of time in New Orleans in recent months in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. When the president was talking about the troublesome directions of our culture that give us pause, he listed a number of things, the health of our most basic institutions. People are concerned about I'm quoting now, about unethical conduct by public officials and discouraged by activist courts that try to redefine marriage, same-sex marriage, we assume. And they worry about children in our society who need direction and love and about fellow citizens still displaced by natural disaster and about suffering caused by treatable disease. And I must say, it struck me one of those things was not like the others, that those misplaced, those who were displaced by natural disaster, people who haven't been able to get back into housing since Katrina, are being presented to us as an example of moral dysfunction, rather than a failure of our public institutions, whether they're municipal, state, or federal. E.J. Dionne, you
exactly.
have any
I think
thoughts?
You did great on standardized tests for picking out the item that was not like the others. And I was struck by the same thing. Indeed, the New Orleans section comes later on in the speech, and it really is a rather sort of desultory set of sentences. It doesn't really say very much, and he almost immediately moves off New Orleans to a much more general line. Let us also work for the day when all Americans are protected by justice, equal in hope, and rich in opportunity. Well, hooray, but it's not very specific about the problems of people in New Orleans. And, you know, Governor Tim Kaine hit him very directly right at the beginning. You know, no matter what political philosophy you hold or what state you call home, you have a right to expect that your government can deliver results. When there's a crime or a fire, you expect police and firefighters to have the tool to respond. Kaine went right at him on Katrina. He mentioned New Orleans in particular. The Kaine speech was also interesting because Kaine is really a pretty moderate guy, but this was a very tough Democratic speech. And I can't resist noting that some people may remember the movie The Candidate, starring Robert Redford.
Yes.
And the candidate in the movie was called McKay, and his slogan was "The Better Way." And so this speech could have been given by Robert Redford, but it was given by Tim Kaine.
C.J. Dionne and Rich Lowry.
I thought Kaine did a pretty good job given the constraints that any responder to the State of the Union deals with. He or she is just always in such a less majestic and stirring setting. It's really hard to compete with the President of the United States. I was struck by two things in particular, though, about Kaine's presentation. One, unless I missed it, I don't think he noted that a key part of the fiscal picture down in there in Virginia recent years has been a huge tax increase, and I think there's a reason he didn't mention that.
His
predecessor,
well,
Mark.
No, that's true. The Republican Party split on it, which is what gave the Democrats cover, and a big part of the reason Tim Kaine got elected. But Republicans would love to have such a fight at the national level. The other thing is, it seems to me, whenever Democrats want to talk about national security, they think supporting veteran benefits is somehow going to make up for their weakness weakness, perceived weakness on national security. Now, veterans' benefits are important. Everyone supports them. But this just does not cut it in the age of the war on terror. And Democrats constantly come back to this. You know, it's a domestic spending program. It doesn't really address how we deal with our enemies abroad.
Well, but the veterans' programs have actually taken a hit during this war, and there does seem to be a disjunction between praising the service of others and the veterans' benefits. But I agree with Rich that I thought Kaine did quite a good job setting it in the governor's mansion. Gave it a kind of regalness that you didn't see in some normal congressional office. I don't know, regalness is not good in a free republic.
There's a fireplace, right?
Yeah, the fireplace.
That's as regal as it gets in these settings.
Yeah, exactly right.
It's a terrible act to try to follow, EJ. I mean,
it's miserable.
The president has hundreds of people rising to their feet after every good line, and the person giving the response is talking to an echoing room somewhere.
Eugene Debs, a great socialist, said there should be another beatitude. Blessed are they who expect nothing, for they shall not be disappointed. In this case, I think Kaine did much better than the average reply, and that's saying something pretty good about a hard job.
Mara Liasson, you have the last word on this evening.
Well, I think that, coming back to Tim Kaine, I think Rich actually has a point here, because when you talk to Democratic strategists, what they say to you is, we're not going to take a backseat to anyone on fighting terrorism. The first and foremost, we're going to make it clear that we want to crush them and use any means at our disposal to crush the terrorist. And then they talk about civil liberties. Tim Kaine didn't really do that. He didn't really do that. He segued right into civil liberties and to veterans. I guess I'm waiting for the tough Democratic response on national security.
NPR's Mara Liasson. Thanks to E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post, also with us in Washington, and Rich Lowry of The National Review has been with us in New York. And we're going to finish up with a recap of tonight's events. President Bush, in front of Congress and in front of the American people as well, delivered his assessment of the State of the Union. On foreign policy, he called on the nation to stay engaged in the world, saying the country cannot find security by abandoning our commitments and retreating within our borders.
By allowing radical Islam to work its will, by leaving an assaulted world to fend for itself, we would signal to all that we no longer believe in our own ideals or even in our own courage. But our enemies and our friends can be certain. The United States will not retreat from the world, and we will never surrender to evil.
Mr. Bush said he was confident in his plan for victory in Iraq, and he spoke to his critics with the words, "Hindsight alone is not wisdom, and second-guessing is not a strategy." On other matters in the Middle East, the president praised recent elections in Egypt. He called again on the Palestinian group Hamas to reject terrorism and to recognize Israel. And he said the world must not permit Iran to develop nuclear weapons. The strongest language of the night was found in the foreign policy section of the speech, but the president did offer a vigorous defense of his domestic eavesdropping program. He said that he has the power to authorize it.
Previous presidents have used the same constitutional authority I have, and federal courts have approved the use of that authority. Appropriate members of Congress have been kept informed. The terror surveillance program has helped prevent terrorist attacks. It remains essential to the security of America. If there are people inside our country who are talking with al-Qaeda, we want to know about it, because we will not sit back and wait to be hit again.
And on the purely domestic front, energy got top billing. Here's what will likely be remembered as the line of the night.
America is addicted to oil, which is often imported from unstable parts of the world. The best way to break this addiction is through technology.
And that from a former oil man. To do that, he called for more clean energy research, including hybrid automobile technology and ethanol. On some other domestic issues, he announced the number of new, relatively modest programs. The American Competitiveness Initiative would double federal funding for research and also increase science teaching in the schools. I'm Robert Siegel, and this has been special coverage of the State of the Union Address.
Support for NPR comes from Prudential Retirement, a Prudential financial business helping thousands of organizations and millions of individuals plan for a secure retirement. Prudential Retirement. From the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life, online at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Elements you put together, I don't see that anyplace else.
A listener talks about This American Life.
And I certainly don't hear those voices anyplace else. So it's like what most media aren't to me, which is surprising.
Surprising Stories, This American Life.
Saturdays at 1 and Sundays at 6 here on WILL Urbana. Ed Kieser's forecast for Champaign-Urbana. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy with a low of 33 degrees. Wind southerly at 8 to 16 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny, breezy, and mild, the high near 50. Wind southerly to southwesterly at 12 to 24 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low of 32 degrees. It's 10 p.m. City Club Forum is next.